everyone, and welcome to Linux or Rest of Us, episode 110. This show about Linux, and we bring you items that we want to talk about Linux, hopefully things that you want to hear about and enjoy yourself, just overall trying to bring more awareness and more knowledge to everyone. I'm only a small part of that equation. My name is Cody Cooper. I'm the co-host, and my other co-host is the larger part of that equation, door-to-door geek Steve McLaughlin. How's it going, Door?
Going pretty good. How about yourself, man?
Dude, I'm having a pretty good week considering a lot of stuff going on at work. I work retail, and man, ramping up for Christmas is just getting crazy. But a lot of good stuff going on at the house. Getting my wife set up with a new laptop, which means I'll have this System 76 laptop all to myself, which means it's going to be distro install time, distro install time, distro install time. So I've mainly been having to keep, I've been trying to keep one DE on there for her to have, you know, for consistency, but now it's going to be mine and I can just go crazy. So yeah, and I'm finally getting my desk built thanks to some guys on Google Plus, which I'll bring up later. How about yourself this week?
Well, I'm on the East Coast, Maryland, so we had to deal with the hurricane, but I got to say, compared to what I saw Jersey and some of New York, we didn't get nothing compared to that. My only pain was no power, which wasn't bad because all I had to do was travel about 2 miles down the street to my father-in-law's house, who never lost power. So we just stayed there. Hence, we're doing this show on a Friday at 3:25 p.m.
Yep. Yeah, Door was up without power for, what, 48 hours at least? Is that right?
Yeah, it was almost three complete days.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know how you did it, but you survived, and as the saying goes, the show must go on. So we're here now. We're still going to pump it out and try to have the audio feed out on time. I don't know if anyone's watching live. If you are, thank you. Appreciate it. Before we get into it, though, there was an announcement made recently by Steve C. For those of you who don't know, Steve C. has started a Kickstarter. And you can go and read all the details at podnuts.com/Kickstarter. And trust me, he didn't ask me to say this stuff. This is just me. And I know it's odd, me as a co-host of one of the shows on the network saying this now, but this is honestly just me, how I feel as a fan. Being a fan and listening to the hundreds of shows over the last 3-4 years now. Go check out the Kickstarter. It's something that's going to benefit the network in the future, and it's something that's going to benefit Steve. What I would ask is, and this is what I ask myself when I ever donate to a Kickstarter. I ask myself, what will I get out of this? Or what have I got from the people involved in this endeavor? Okay. Now, you know as well as I do, if you're listening to this show, you know who Steve C is. He built it from the ground up by himself. He not only continued one show for over 300 episodes, but he branched off and made many others, which has benefited thousands of people, maybe even tens of thousands of people over the last 4 years. All I would ask you to seriously consider is ask yourself, what have I got out of these shows? Whether it's just overall knowledge, if it helped you start a business, if it just got you reinterested in tech, if it got you talking to new friends online, whatever the case, ask yourself what he has done for you as far as all these shows. What has it brought to your life or to your livelihood? And do what you can to give back. I never try to pitch things to you guys. I mean, I'll talk about the ACF and things I believe in. This is something I believe in. Don't do it for me. And don't do it for Door. Do it for Steve. Anything that you can do, just really ask yourself, what have I got out of this, and what can I give back to help him this one time? And that's basically all I have to say. But yeah, definitely go check out podnuts.com/Kickstarter. There are more details on there. You will be rewarded whatever you can contribute. And so I just ask you, do what you can. We're going to roll into Linux news now. Thank you so much for listening to that, guys. And hopefully you understand why it was important.
Yep.
So,
and we're going to let you guys know probably 4 more times till the end of the Kickstarter. So thank you.
What do we got this week, Door?
Well, the first thing I want to do was follow up from last week. Last week, I was extremely I don't want to say undereducated. I was quick with the tongue without a lot of research about totally disabling any updates installs on a Linux system if you wanted to give it to a quote-unquote customer to avoid any issues. Well, I did at least some research this week because I knew it was possible, but I didn't know what it took. So one of the things I found out was if you disable automatic check for updates in software sources in Ubuntu, and I believe it's the same in Linux Mint, you can change it from daily to never. What people have to really understand is all that does is stop the notification from prompting you that you do have updates. It will still not stop a user from applying all pending updates or checking for updates by hand. Okay, so this is not the answer to me. This is a very half-baked way of trying to answer the question. What I did find out is you can limit sudo access or enhance or change or modify. One of the biggest things I figured out was you can, for instance, give this user passwordless access to install applications. So they can just bang install without ever being even prompted for a password. But it is possible to block upgrading. So they would not be able to do an upgrade on the kernel, and a upgrade on the entire operating system, an upgrade on Unity or anything else. And that is taking advantage of the /sudoers file. Sudoers file. In that file, it basically has a little bit of a format explaining what people can do. If you go look at yours right now, you will see your username has all access or root access, which means you can do everything with your default username as the root user can do. You're just prompted for a password. By just adding the no pass WD option, you don't have to ever be asked a password, but by default, it's always smart to, in my opinion, and you can limit it to certain commands. And there's a little bit of way to go a little bit deeper on that. Over on Ubuntu forums is where I found this article. It will be in the show notes. And right here, restricted application usage. You can basically grant, here they're giving explicit no password access to the username Jaunty for apt-get update and apt-get upgrade. So,
oh, okay.
Basically, you can just twist this around a little bit, give them blanket access to apt-get install, but require a password for apt-get update and apt-get upgrade, and then you just don't give them the password.
On the flip side of that, you could also disable a password prompt for yourself. That way it's just one less, I mean, that much less typing for yourself. So yeah, that is a very useful tool.
Well, I'll say it can be a deterrent. This all stems from what if you want to offer Linux to home users?
Definitely, yeah.
You know, because most home users, if you give them an inch of power, they will accidentally stab themselves in the heart, is the way that I, equate it.
They might break it, right, Thor?
Well, they will break it. Just a question of, they will they get irate in the same instance?
There you go.
Okay, this next one, I had to add in, it literally was the closest thing possible to last second. I just noticed a new feature in Google Hangouts called Cameraman, which I don't know if you have the ability to do here. Allows you to control when each participant is shown in your broadcast. Whatever. Sorry.
I saw that. That's interesting.
Diverted. Mind diverted. Okay. Frank Forrester, besides being an extremely hacker mentality guy, which means he's the guy who 30 years ago, 40 years ago, would have every knuckle would be bloody because he would always be physically into something, tearing it apart, rewiring it, nuts and bolts changing, trying to do all kinds of cool stuff on something. Now, in the digital age, he tries to manipulate, change, in some cases, pwn any piece of hardware or software he can get his hands on. And he sent me this maybe an hour and a half ago. It's a Raspberry Pi thing, number one. Number two, it is essentially a POTS thing. Plain old telephone system, POTS. I've been very anti-POTS for a really long time because it seems like the general overall audio quality seems to be horrendous versus VoIP. So my logic is, if I have the choice between POTS and VoIP, why am I ever going to go POTS? Right. There is some need for it, though. You know, if you actually want to have a phone in your house that you can pick up the handle, dial a number, you know, you're going to need either a POTS service or a PBX service. PBX service is basically a system that can convert POTS to VoIP and VoIP to POTS. Okay, so what you do is you get yourself a $35 Raspberry Pi, 42 after shipping, whatever. And then there's this link over at nerdviddles.com, I believe.
Yep.
And there's an article called "What's as good as a $35 Raspberry Pi? How about 35 free incredible PBX apps?" Now, see, the only thing lacking with this article is an actual step-by-step or explanation. But that's not what this article is supposed to be. This article is just supposed to be a jumping-off point for ideas and concepts. If you want to, it's just a Google search away, okay? They literally go through 35 different things you can do as it relates to a PBX system, a Raspberry Pi, and phones. For instance, number 17, music on hold management. So you could have this set up in your house, and then you can have that set up to where every time you hit ** on your phone, the person gets put on hold in your house. And then you could automatically play them some music by Luke Fontaine, some EDM by Luke Fontaine, without having what used to cost thousands of dollars of hardware and hundreds to tens of thousands of dollars of software sitting in a back room. I really honestly encourage anyone who wants to either automate things in their house, have a true PBX system set up for a small business or in their own house, wants to be able to do voicemails or even prompts. Like, you could literally have in your house, the phone rings. They, you know, it answers and says, "Hello, you're connected to the house of Door to Door Geek. If you would like to get in touch with Mrs. Door to Door Geek, please press 1. And then I could make it so the phone in the living room and the phone in the bedroom are the only phones that ring when you hit 1. And then it could say, "If you want to get in touch with Little Door to Door Geek, press 2. And then that could ring my oldest son's room, and that's it.
That's, you know, awesome.
And it's technically very plausible, very feasible, very possible with most of these PBX systems. I will say the number one popular one is called Asterisk. Asterisk does have a couple derivatives built off of it, but Asterisk is really the one. And I will say that is the one that if you learn to any degree, you can easily go out and get a job for $50,000 to $60,000+ a year just setting up PBX systems.
Man.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the beauty of the internet and the Raspberry Pi, people. $35, download free software, pay maybe $80 total in hardware around your house. You can become efficient enough to set up enterprise grade PBX systems.
Yeah. Well, more importantly, that's one of the many things that you can do with the Raspberry Pi. And you got to think, this is really the tip of the iceberg because it's only been around for a few months. I mean, obviously, there are projects in the works and they're trying to do more stuff with this device. Now, real quick, Door, kind of an offshoot of this. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at buying a couple of them. And what at this point, in to the best of your knowledge, what site would you suggest I go get my Raspberry Pis from at this point?
If you give me 1 second, I will actually give you the correct full name of it. If you go to raspberrypi.org, you will see on the right-hand side a couple links. There's actually only two links, even though it looks like there's three. Okay, RS and Element 14. I'm 99.999% sure if you order it from RS, you literally get it in a week and a half. If you order it from Element 14, it might take a week. It might take 3 weeks. It might take 3 months. Oof. And I think here's the whole reason why. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm going to say on Element 14, they almost encourage you ever so gently to buy bundles and right. not just a Raspberry Pi. I believe they give people who order bundles preferential treatment. So if you just want the Pi, I believe it is uk.rs-online.com. That okay. is the site to go just buy a Pi. That's what I do.
Okay. And then now you purchased two of them, and I'm not trying to get off on a big tangent. I'm asking for myself and for the people who might want to buy one who haven't got it yet. Because now the 512 meg model is out. Where would you suggest getting the proper AC adapter? Because I think that that's the one tricky thing if you're not really knowing what you're doing that you need to buy. Because anyone can get a USB hub or an SD card or an HDMI cable. But where would you suggest getting one of those with the right voltage and all that?
You don't. You just go buy from the dollar store a typical micro USB phone charger.
Oh, okay. So it
I've never seen one of them not work. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you had to have. I thought I had a special port, but that makes more sense. Okay. Well, I got plenty of those, so I'm good. Fantastic. And of course, if it were me, well, where I'm going to buy my case is onto eBay and searching for a Cook Technic to get Russ's hard metal case for that. If you guys ever check that out, do it. Look up Russ Winter, techiegeek.com. I'm sure he has a link to it from there. Amazing case for your Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Next thing I wanted to bring up, only because I could not find another avenue to bring this up and on the other show. Period. So I'm being selfish. Over at device.com, mm-hmm. it's definitely I don't want to say enhanced story, but they definitely play it up, I'll say. Okay. Ethiopian kids hack OL PCs in 5 months with zero instructions. First, backstory. Okay. The one laptop per child people have created a tablet. We cannot get them yet, as far as I know. They literally took boxes of these into towns in Africa, put the boxes in the middle of the town, and then basically left. They did observe, but they explicitly did not interact. Okay. What they wanted to find out was if we drop these in an area, do we have to spend sometimes hundreds and hundreds of dollars on education to make sure people can use these devices? Okay. So essentially, they drop these tablets in a small village where supposedly most of the kids can't read, kind of thing, or excuse me, have never even seen a printed word, is their thing. And what they found out was, within a couple days, the average, I don't know how they were able to connect. They don't go over that. But I believe these had actually default Android installed on them with a little bit of customization, a little bit of tweaks. Within a couple days, they had over 40 applications installed on the average device. Within a couple weeks, they figured out how to enable the camera, which they disabled. For some mm-hmm. reason, one of the guys disabled them. They figured out how to enable the camera, and in a couple months, a couple people figured out how to load custom Android on it.
Wow.
So the hacker mentality is not something that has to be explicitly taught. Okay. If it's in you, it's in you. People have it. People do it. Even, dare I say, Ethiopian kids who have never seen the written word before. Hacking has nothing to do with education, is what I take away from this story. people who have that desire to get, like Frank, get bloody knuckles getting into stuff, it's there, irregardless of education level. And it's obvious at least a couple kids in this Ethiopian town displayed that, in my opinion.
Definitely. I mean, it's... Yeah, it's quite an amazing experiment, and to see what they did in that short period of time. And, I mean, loading custom Android ROMs, I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. I just thought this was, in my, the best way I can put it, it was a feel-good thing.
Definitely. Well, any positive that comes from this test, I mean, hopefully they'll just be able to hand them out even more widespread, and then... I mean, yeah, great job, kids. That's all I can really say. That's so cool.
Okay, this was another thing. I honestly had no place to throw it, but I had to throw it someplace only because I wanted people to be aware of it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The only way I can put this is the internet does not run off of love and hope and kindness. The internet runs off of money. That's a fact. Okay. And what this site, it's actually called rcs.searinteractive.com, it looks like, slash money. They basically go through an explanation of how these people, places, sites, services make money. Okay, you can go and you can click here on Evernote. Like, how possibly could they make money? And it's because they have a freemium model. Everybody has used Evernote at some point in the past. What they do is they hold back specific features, abilities, enhancements, options, whatever, in the free version. And until you're already sitting down, comfortable, experienced, and like it, then you realize, I need more. And then they offer you the pay model for those explicit services. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that they can make money. To me, the freemium is one of the more positive ways of making money. But that is how they make money off of us.
Yep. And it's a great model to go with, too.
Yeah, and then Adobe Flash Player. Okay, here's a good example. How possibly could Adobe Flash be making money off of it? It makes no sense. They're just a little thing you download and install to play videos of people getting kicked between the crotch and stuff. I mean, that's all it is, right? Well, no. There's actually a subscription model with Adobe Flash. What I believe that is to have certain amount of encoding rights. You have to pay for it. That's a subscription you have to pay for. They have a freemium model. They do have Adobe Flash Creator Pro or something like that, that if you buy, you get an enhanced interface to create interactive Flash content. They also make a whole lot of money off of royalties. That much I know, they make a lot of money off of royalties. So that's why Flash has been around as long as it has, and is or still around. It's because it's making revenue for Adobe. But there's a whole bunch of them too, man. I mean, everything about how does Apple make money on apps, how does it make money on iTunes, Google Android, Google Chrome, Instagram, Groupon, Grooveshark,
Craigslist, Dropbox, eBay, DuckDuckGo, Netflix, Twitter, Tumblr. I mean, Wolfram Alpha, Radio.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, if you're interested, check out this link, because it really does make you think. I mean, if you really have no concept of how big these entities are and where they're getting the majority of their cash, go check it out.
Oh, I guess I should send this to Steve too. There's a way that Kickstarter does.
Oh,
yeah.
Podcast.com/Kickstarter.
Exactly. I just found it interesting, and I had no other avenue to talk about it, so I just wanted to let people know about it.
Yeah, there you go. It was quick and easy.
Yeah, nothing. The Beatles did say the best things in life are free, but some things on the internet do cost money.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, this next one, I'm just going to throw out there super quick. A lot of people do not understand how the back end of Linux can do password security. I mean, wireless security, sorry, from WPA1, WPA2, Leap, and other types of wireless security. And here's the only reason why it becomes an issue. A, you're running a desktop that's not picking up the security on your wireless access point correctly, or B, you're running a server instance that has a wireless card connected to it, which is possible. Okay. Mm. If you're running a server distro, typically you do not install a GUI unless your name is Mark Cockrell. We're not getting to get into that.
Okay.
But most people do not want the GUI on a server OS, period. Well, if you don't have a GUI, most people have no idea of how to actually create wireless configurations and connect wirelessly to other stuff. Hence this Ubuntu forums.org page I found. It literally goes through step by step by step by step by step with nice color coding too, which I like, where it basically shows you how to create configuration files, so when your server boots up or your non-GUI instance boots up, it will automatically connect to an access point.
I'll be really interested to check this out later because I'm trying to get more security conscious. I'm in the middle of redoing my whole office, which I have been for months, and you guys have probably already heard me talk about that, but I set up a wireless router for someone, a friend of mine recently, and it was some weird brand I'd never heard of, and it was some Woot deal she got or whatever, and interface I wasn't familiar with, just a little bit of Googling under Linux Mint, which is what she has installed on her laptop, and it was all good to go. So yeah, having another avenue to sort of lock this down and get more familiar with it, it's definitely going to be worthwhile, so check it out.
Right, and I'll say by the end of the first section, the first posting, they give you a list of useful commands associated with this kind of task. That is good to have. I will say that. Then if you go down to the next posting, for instance, they give you a whole bunch of commands on how to start your network. Here's a workaround that helps restart the network during boot, so one does not have to do it manually after logging in, because if there's a hiccup. And this guy basically tells you step by step by step how to set it up so when your computer fully boots, it will restart the network and restart that connection process. I just thought it was a really good link, a really good find.
Definitely.
Very cool stuff. Okay, this next one, I'm not going to lie. If there was ever a time to put on your propeller beanie kind of thing, this is it right here. Okay. There's one issue that some users come across when they switch out of Ubuntu. Okay. There's Debian stable, Debian testing, and Debian SID. And SID, going by Toy Story analogy, is the unstable Debian. Okay. So the logic becomes you want to run Debian stable because it's stable, but Debian stable doesn't have the newest, the hottest, the shiniest applications to install.
You gotta be on that bleeding edge.
Yeah, so if Firefox is up to 20, version 20, Debian stable might only be up to 16, but you really want to install Firefox 20.
Right.
A lot of people, when they jump out of the Ubuntu wagon into a different distro wagon, they come up to this hurdle and they think their only choice is now reinstall Debian SID because I need that latest greatest. Hmm. On virtually any, and by virtually I mean everyone I know of, Debian-based distribution, you can do a thing called app pinning. Okay, what app pinning is essentially saying, I'm running Debian stable. I'm going to add the repository for Debian SID, but I want to only pin how my computer connects to SID. I only want it to connect to SID for Firefox.
Okay.
So what will happen is then you go do an apt-get update, apt-get upgrade, it will essentially do two different tasks. It will go to the stable repository, get all the updates for your desktop, for your network manager, for your kernel, for your Abbey Word, for your VLC, for whatever. But then it will go to Debian Sid and just get the updates for Firefox. This can be an insanely useful tactic if you want a good combination, and I mean a very good combination, of a rock-solid, stable base operating system, but you want to toy and play with maybe a bleeding-edge application. And the thing is, it's really not hard at all. They give in this article on, I can't even pronounce that, Jackable. Jackale.sb.org.
Oh, like a
Jacque.shibi.org.
Yeah, it's a the link will be in the show notes. It's quite interesting, I'll say that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not Dor's fault. He cannot pronounce that. I don't think anyone, well, I mean, someone has to be able to, but yeah, it's not his fault.
All right. And I'll say, as long as you can read a little bit, I'm not a reader, but as long as you can read a little bit, you'll definitely get the gist of it. They show you where the sources.list file is. That's where all of the repo information goes. And they say that your sources list may look like this, where it has in there stable, testing, unstable. And then you can go in and set preferences, or you can say package, release, priority. Priority is how it determines. If you give something a priority of 1 and a priority of 10, priority of 10 will win every time because it's priority of 10. And then they go through a little bit more and they actually show you how you can say apt-get install package, and then after it you put /unstable. That is referenced back in the earlier part in the file called preferences in etc apt preferences. So you got to do a couple things. You got to jump around to a couple files to get this system together, working and functioning, but it is so easy to utilize after that. I honestly encourage people to set up a VM, a VirtualBox instance of Debian stable, go to this link and toy around with it. I guarantee you, you're going to learn something about how Debian works and how you can pick and choose where you want your packages in installed from.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to break it down in my language, in my own words. But you can basically choose now. For those of you who aren't who have never run Debian before, I would suggest running Debian stable just to have that stable version of it just to start off with. But instead of leaping over to Debian testing, you can kind of take a la carte and decide what you want to, you know, flick the switch for. Like, well, I'll go, you know, bleeding edge on this and bleeding edge on that and stable on this. And the more you're able to tweak that, the better. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not wrong. Right. I am right. Okay. Good. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. And if you guys aren't familiar with Debian, I mean, so many derivatives of it, Ubuntu being one, and then many from there on. So yeah, go back to the source and try it sometime. Yeah. I installed it on a Mac once. Mm. Worked just great.
Yeah, and I'll say, if you want to get into Ubuntu Enterprise stuff, you really can do one of two, Debian or Red Hat. And with Red Hat, you have CentOS and Fedora and whatever. But with Debian, Debian, I believe, is more popular on web servers, where Red Hat is more popular on internal enterprise servers. So if you want to get into making money off of Linux servers, you have to first pick, do you want public-facing internet servers or do you want internal enterprise servers?
And there you go, yeah.
And doing app pinning can give you a web server with the ultra hottest, freshest software on it, with having the utterly rock solid, stable, and secure back end.
Yep. It also gives you the ability to kind of pre-tweak instead of post-tweak.
Right.
I guess would be a way to say it, but definitely a cool bring up door. What else do we have this week?
You put a link in here to a...
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, I like to see this. I don't know what you guys think about Linux on newer hardware. I love it. I think that as long as it's priced correctly, because, I mean, the article that I posted was on Linux Mint Inc.'s another hardware deal. And we've seen Mint put on some hardware in the past, and then you look at the price for what you get, and it's just, it's not a little more, it's like borderline ridiculous, would you say, Dor?
To be honest, for what it looks like you're getting, I think it is absurd. I think you should almost be able to get two of them for that same price.
Right, in some instances. This one, the link I found on omgubuntu.co.uk, but the site is thinkpenguin.com, mm-hmm. and they have a little tiny PC, almost looks like a Mac Mini, I think they even have some of these and some laptops starting like $249, which... Yeah. I mean, it's not out of the reach of most people, especially if you're looking for something that will run that Linux will run great on, which is most hardware anyway. But if you're looking for some hardware, I mean, there are other vendors, you know, like System76 is a reason, a few others. But as these companies get more traction, it's just going to make put Linux in the hands of more people. So overall, I think it's good as long as they have the point of entry at a decent level to where more people can actually get a hold of this stuff.
Absolutely. And I'll say the omgubuntu.co.uk article to me was almost misleading. When I go to the site, I realize the hardware specs they were talking about were not almost $500, but they were the $249 model. So when I said twice as expensive, $249 for those hardware specs, I don't want to say it's reasonable, but it's much, much, much more reasonable.
Right. Right.
So I do feel better at that, but I will say if you go up to the $344 model, you get a genuine. Okay, now one thing I got to say, I absolutely hate and despise, and I think it's utterly incompetent of ThinkPenguin.com. They only show you one picture of the device, and it looks like it could be a concept graphic and not a real physical picture. I want to see front, top, side, and back views of something I'm going to buy for multiple hundreds of dollars.
They have the multiple views of the laptops I'm looking at right now, if you click on it. Yeah.
Yeah, but not this mini...
Oh, not the mini PC.
No. But I will say, I'm going to look at the expensive one, because to me, that one looks a lot better. $344, you get a Intel Pentium dual-core 2.3 gigahertz processor. Don't know how much cache is on that processor, but I'm guessing it's okay. 2 gigs of DDR3, which in Linux is very acceptable. You know, you could always do more, but 2 gigs is probably acceptable. Mm-hmm. The 80 gigabyte hard drive has to be a spinning disk. Hopefully it's not a laptop disk going 5,600 RPM, but I do not see exact specifications on that. If it is, you might want to limit your swap size, I'll say, because that would slow it down.
Right.
But the other specs about it aren't bad, and it does say, which I think is hilarious, compatible with Microsoft Windows 7.
Boo.
Yeah, not good. Graphics port is DVI and VGA. Audio is Realtek, which everybody knows. You can bump it up to, it says, 16 gigs of DDR3. Wow.
Jeez.
Yeah.
16 gigs of RAM in a little box.
Yeah. Well, in a box that we can't tell how little it is, but it looks like it should be little.
Right. It could be bigger than my whole desk. I don't know. It doesn't say anything about dimensions. Oh, no, wait. No, hold on. 8 by 8 inches by 2.5 inches tall.
There 8 by 8?
8 by 8. That's still pretty big. That's
a lot bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Looking at the picture on their... estimated, I guess, picture, if you look at the $249 model, it makes it look like it's all of 4 inches.
Yeah, 4x4x2 or whatever. So, yeah.
Obviously, that's not a real picture. It's a graphic that they made.
Still, I'm interested to see the real pictures. I wish them luck. And if it gets more people using Linux, I'm all for it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they're going to give back 10% of the money to Mint, which I got to say, it can't be bad for Mint to do this, and it can't be bad for Think Penguin to do that either.
Mm-hmm. That was something that Jonathan Nadeau was doing when he was running Frostbite Systems, right?
I believe he was giving back more than 10%, but he was giving back a percentage. But mm-hmm. he was giving it to any distro you picked. If you would call him up and say, I want SlitAz installed, he would find a way to get them the money.
Right. And yeah, that brings them in my eyes a little bit more legitimacy, because it's mm-hmm. it's one thing for some, you know, cheap hardware vendor to just come in and go, yeah, we're going to put Linux on and it's going to be great and we're just going to make a lot of money. But for them to actually go back to the community who are helping them make money for developing the software, to say, you know what, we thank you, here's a little token back, we appreciate it, I think that's great.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And hopefully this company is successful with these, and the more successful they are, my guess is the more they'll be able to reduce the price, make it more efficient, you know, process, and offer more devices. That's always good.
You got that right.
Okay, this next thing I wanted to bring up, I honestly believe the first place I heard about it was on Sunday Morning Linux Review or smlr.us.
Shout outs to Mary.
Yeah, Mary's the bomb diggity.
She is.
Every week they do a bunch of stuff, but the one thing they do is, I want to say, Tony goes through new releases, and it's basically just a really quick blurb. Here it is. Here's their tagline. Next. Here it is. Here's their tagline. Next. And they just go through sometimes 6 or 8 in a week.
Oh, okay.
Well, one of them they mentioned that caught my ear a little bit, but I still haven't had a chance to fully check out, but I think it's cool. It can be ultra cool, is all I gotta say. It's called OpenElect 2.0. OpenElect 2.0. Disclaimer, I have no idea how to rationalize the name of the distro with what it does. It has nothing to do about openness. It has nothing to do about elections or electricity.
Electronics, perhaps?
I don't know. I don't know. What this aims to be is basically a appliance-like home theater PC interface. Why didn't they call it Open HTPC or something? I mean, I don't know. Right. Call me crazy. But I will say the interface looks ultra sharp and TV centric. It doesn't look overcomplicated with little words and lots of little pictures. It looks like very much an interface optimized for a big screen, laid back, quote unquote, experience.
Yeah, it's pretty slick. Just a kind of a quick description. Obviously, you can put different skins on it and wallpapers and whatnot, but up at the top, it almost has a tabbed browser like interface where you can go to the home. And then currently, the screenshot I'm looking at, he has his settings up. But you can configure and control things such as you know, video, live TV, music, pictures, weather, the network system, different add-ons. So it'd be interesting to see what other kind of software you could throw onto this. I'm sure you could set up like some home automation stuff with this, possibly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, overall, it looks very cool.
Well, the beautiful thing is, behind the scenes, it's technically Linux. So anything you can do on Linux, you could do on there too. You could do an SSH into it and do a whole bunch of little back-end things. And I will say the actual website is openelect.tv, which to me looks like a good site, but I'm gonna channel Steve C here. Where's the link to the screenshots, okay? There's not a single link on their main page to simple friggin' screenshots. To me, that's one of the easiest way to sell people on things is screenshots. And they don't have it anywhere. I will say it does look like it is piggybacking off of the XBMC technology. Okay, backstory. XBMC, Xbox Media Center. When Xbox 360 came out, they decided to become their own thing, and they went away from Xbox. They became a Linux-based tool for home theater type experiences. Boxy took XBMC, further developed it, then dropped Linux support. I don't think they picked it back up yet. So these people are taking that same XBMC, which is a perfectly adequate home theater type interface onto itself, and they're enhancing it even more with OpenElect. That alone makes me want to try it. I don't know if I can get it past the wife, i.e. unless it ships her like a shrimp pasta dinner two nights a week, I don't see how I'm going to get it past her approval, but I can try.
Yeah, I'm on their site now, and I'm not seeing any screenshots. I mean, I'm talking about OpenElect's main site. I'm not seeing any screenshots.
Yeah, some people just don't do it.
Yeah, well, and then again, I've only been digging on it for less than 30 seconds. By all means, write in your email and prove me wrong.
No, it should be right there.
No, yes. It should be, boom, in the above the fold on the page, as anyone who's created a website knows, it's got to be right front and center. That's what you should see first, but I'm not going to judge. It's fine. Regardless, interesting technology. I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. Needless to say, even though of its shortcoming, it still looks like it's very adequate and cool to use. But again, worst case scenario, download it in a VM and just bang on a little bit, see what you think about it.
Very good.
Okay, I think we had one more link in here, Cody.
Yep, one more that I brought today, which I knew it was going to happen. Everybody knew it was going to happen. Someone has finally successfully loaded Ubuntu successfully on the new Samsung ARM Chromebook, which, for those of you who don't know, the Chromebook only costs $249. So the ARM-powered device, priced cheaply at $249, boasts a dual-core ARM processor clocked at 1.7 gigahertz, quad-core Mali T604 for graphics, and a thin and lightweight design at 11-inch screen, which is 1366 by 768 resolution, 2 gigs of RAM, and a 16-gig SSD. For $250, I mean, it's got to be a speedy little device. It's paper thin, and now people are loading Linux on it.
Yeah, I definitely, because of the price point, I think there's a lot of people out there who, once they saw that, had to go stop themselves from clicking and trying to buy one right now.
Right.
Because
right.
You're essentially getting what could be kind of easily equated to a $350 plus laptop.
Oh, for sure.
Functionality where you just have to hack it, pwn it, install Ubuntu. And, you know, if you can install Ubuntu, you can install anything you want. Just might take a little bit more work.
And the top comment currently is Hannah Montana Linux ? The best kind. So it could run Dora's favorite distro.
I don't know what you're talking about. I actually think that might be Peter 64. And I'm saying this because I know he doesn't even listen, but I think that's Peter 64's favorite distro. But I'll be sure to double check that.
Okay. Very cool. But yeah, and you know, I mean, being as small, and I don't know how many of you, I mean, obviously some of you guys have to own laptops. I don't know how many of you carry them with you day to day, but I brought, I made a trip a month before I went to OLF down to San Antonio, and I took my old HP DV2000 with me. And I think, well, it's not going to be that big of a deal. It's a slightly older, bulkier laptop. It might weigh, I don't know, 6 pounds, 5-6 pounds. But I got to tell you, lugging that thing around, and I'm a big guy, I'm not a small person, but I mean, it was killing my back in my backpack. Yeah, I had a lot of other stuff in there too, but man, once I took it out and carried my backpack around, it was crazy. So if you're looking for a cheaper, thinner laptop, especially at that price point, I mean, that's one hell of a deal. Now, keep in mind the version of 1204 that they installed on it, it's still in alpha stages, so there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work, but it's that foot in the door. Right door. It's that foot in the door to get this working even better. Much like you're seeing Ubuntu installed on like the Nexus 7. I mean, there are some things that aren't going to work correctly first, but man, 2, 3, 6, 12 months from now, I mean, we're going to be able to do a lot more with these devices. There will be more of them, and have something lightweight like this to carry around. It's a great deal. It's especially for the price.
Yeah, and I was going to say they're calling the Respin, because that's essentially what it has to be. Mm-hmm. Of Ubuntu, Crubuntu, CHRUBUNTU for Chrome. Here's real quick reason why they have to do that. virtually every major Linux distro, except of course for Debian and a couple other ones, have virtually dropped all support for other processors, and they're all shooting after Intel and AMD 32 and 64 bit processors.
Mm-hmm.
Ubuntu has, at least behind the scenes, been developing ARM based Ubuntu's for like the Nexus 7. Well, a guy basically took Ubuntu 12.04 and respun it for this dual core ARM support, because this device has a dual core ARM processor in it, 1.7.
Yep. 1.7.
Oh,
yeah.
And a quad graphics. Okay. So he basically had to respin it. Hence, now we have Krubuntu 12.04. Which I just think is interesting. $249. I mean, really?
Dude, yeah.
Now, disclaimer, because you got to do disclaimer. Sound doesn't work. It's coming. Of course, this is brand spanking new. Cody literally picked it up right when it hit the street.
Yep.
Touchpad, not perfect. It's just a question of figuring out which touchpad it is and then how to implement the driver for it. And no GPU acceleration. This is where I'm sure he's going to need other people to help step up and either develop drivers for it or find another piece of similar hardware where Linux is installed and pulling the driver out that way.
Yep. Now, if you don't have access to the show notes quickly, you can go check this out. It was posted on omg.ubuntu.co.uk. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely go check this out.
Yeah, and I'll say what does work right out of the box. Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, battery, card reader, and USB. So I obviously said more things that did work that didn't work. So it should just keep getting better.
You got that right. All right, Dor. I think that was the last of our actual topics for the week. We have a bunch of emails. I'm going to get through a bunch of them now. And a lot of these emails were sent in regards to my question from last week, which was involving children with Linux. And I appreciate you guys sending them in. We'll finish as many of these as we can tonight, and we'll get them started right now. This was my favorite email that we got this week. It's from our good old friend John Zim writes, "Cody rocks. That is all." That's all he wrote.
Well, did he need to say anything more?
I guess not. And thank you, John. But John Zim, you also rock. So thank you for listening to the shows. And for those of you who don't know John Zim, hit him up on Google Plus, for friend him, definitely follow him. Great guy, loves Linux. Great, great, great fun guy. Thanks for writing in, John. And this was in response to, and for those of you who didn't listen last week, basically my son, who's just around 15 months old, he started to play with my tablets, and I put him in front of a laptop today, which I'll post some pictures on. It was pretty hilarious. I was just kind of asking, for those of you who have kids that you've introduced to open source software or any hardware starting from a young age, what did you do? Share your experiences with me. And our good friend Jonathan Nato wrote in, and he said, "Hey guys, my 10-year-old son has been using GNU Linux for 3 or 4 years now. The way to get them is to use GNU Linux is to make it the only thing to use. He also helps me with building Sonar, and without his help, it wouldn't be possible. He can install Fedora, Ubuntu, Linux Mint, and Debian by himself. He is a free software advocate already." Jonathan Nato. And his, 10 years old. So he started doing this at 6, 7 years old. That is awesome.
Well, and he said it almost a little abruptly, and people might think a little bit harshly. The way to get them involved is make it their only choice. But if you stop and think about it, most households, the kid gets involved using Windows because it's the only choice, or gets involved with Mac because it is their only choice. So don't think how he's putting it is a bad thing. If that's what the kid sees, if that's what the kid is able to play with, that is what the kid is going to know.
You got that
so
right.
If you as a parent want to guide them towards Linux, it's easy. Make it their choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one thing I picked up from it.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a positive message, and it really made me think to years ago. One of my old tech friends, name's Gabe, he was setting up his mother, and this was like 10, 12 years ago, was setting up his mother with a PC. She had never used a computer in her life. And by that time, she was in her mid-late 40s. He put Mandrake on it, and she loved it. But she had never used Windows. She had never used OS X. So literally, it does speak to what Jonathan was saying. Whatever you put in front of them and they learn on, is as long as you're helping nurture that, I mean, don't feel like you're confining them or limiting them, but it's just getting them interested in tech, getting used to using OSs. And I'm sure if you sat him down in front of Windows, based on what he knows is what he's done in Linux, he would be able to navigate, maybe not Windows 8, but he would be able to navigate a regular desktop, which is good. And thank you, Jonathan, for writing in and saying that.
Absolutely.
All right. Denning writes, "Hello, Steve. Hello, Dor. There is a Kickstarter project for a parallel computer that will cost $99 and apparently the size of a credit card. Take a guess at what the OS is going to be. Looks like it will ship with Ubuntu. I do not know if they will get their funding. Hopefully they can make it. Cheers, Denning." Although Denning didn't include a link, I'll try to find the link and then include it in the show notes.
Yeah, I did find it, but I don't remember it being super easy to find, and I think I found it on my work computer, so I can't access the history here. Let me see. Parallel supercomputer for everyone. Yeah, this is it. It's funded. This project has successfully met its goal 6 days ago. They were asking for $750,000, and they made their goal over and above. They're up to $898,000. Now, I'm just saying, folks, Steve C's asking for a hell of a lot less than that. The least we can do is help him out.
Yep. Well, thank you, Denning. And yeah, if you guys ever see any of these little products pop up, let us know, because I love seeing this stuff. Because, man, like I said, it's just spreading the seed out there, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Okay. Next email, Jacob Minchel writes, "Hey, just listening to the latest podcast, I had an interesting story to share with you about the Pi. I ordered mine on the 29th of September and was waiting all month to get it. I just got it today, well, yesterday. Now it's 4 a.m. and I've been up all night messing with the Pi. I received an email, I believe, on the 14th or 16th that my 256 meg model had been upgraded for free to the 512 megabyte model. I bet they were out of stock for a little on the 256 meg model, and they were just waiting for a big shipment of the 512s to come in. I got mine off Newark.com. Very happy with it so far. Going to leave it running and try to SSH to it from outside my house to access my own personal files without a Dropbox. Cheers, Jacob."
Very cool. How did you spell that URL that he said he got it from?
Newark, like Newark, New Noah's Ark, Newark.com.
There you go. Can't say I've heard of that one. Oh, that's a Element 14 subsidiary.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
I'm guessing this is an American subsidiary. Very good to know.
Yeah. But yeah, if you guys have stories of the Pi, send them in. I'd love to hear them. Okay. Rolling right along. Toby writes, "Dear Steve, I've been an avid listener of all your podcasts, apart from the Pod Brewers one. As a recovering alcoholic, it probably wouldn't be too appropriate. For almost a year now, which is roughly when I started to get interested in tech, before which I was a complete Luddite technophobe. Listening to you and others like you has transformed me into a full-on Linux and Android geek with an insatiable thirst for techie knowledge in less than a year. Also, it has contributed in giving me a new positive focus and fresh set of goals and aims in my life. Basically, I just wanted to get in touch with you and thank you for all the hard work you put in. I wanted you to know how appreciated and inspiring it is. Through the shows you contribute to, I have not only learned a lot about tech, but also thanks also to the amazing work of Jonathan Nado, apologies if I spelt that wrong, which he did not, about related issues such as accessibility, and in your most recent contribution to HPR about your struggles with a speech impediment. Although I don't share the exact issues of either you or Mr. Nado, like most people listening, I've suffered my own trials and tribulations and find it immensely powerful and inspiring to hear about those of someone I look up to and consider to be an exceptionally nice human being. Anyway, dude, keep up the awesome work. Your help to make the world a better place. And I hope that someday I can follow in your footsteps. I'm currently just starting an open university course in the UK. It's a way to get a degree part-time without getting into crazy debt. in computing and ICT. I recently joined my local LUG and went to my first conference, OgCamp 12 in Liverpool, this summer, and hope to one day have a Linux maven status like yourself. All the best, mate, and good luck with all your future projects and goals. Toby.
I obviously need to send him a check or something. To be honest, this is the kind of email that just, to me, reinforces, you know, what we all do here at Podnuts and why we all do what we do here at Podnuts. I can't believe he spelled Nadu correctly. That's, this guy's like genius or something.
He did.
I never spell it right. And I did do an HPR episodes. I will say a disclaimer. I'm pretty sure it got at least a little bit colorful in the middle, and it's only because I could is what I'll say. It was about basically my speech impediment, my history with it, how it appears to me some other people think about it and react to it, and how we as people with speech impediments need to stop telling ourselves what we can and can't do, why we should and why we shouldn't, and most importantly, care at all what other people actually think about us.
Definitely. I had a mild stammer when I was a kid, and it still acts up every once in a while. It more feels, and I think I've heard you describe it this way, it's more like all the words just get completely blocked in your mind and you can't speak them fast enough. Yeah. Something like that. And honestly, I didn't know about your HPR episode until I read this email, which means that you didn't advertise it, at least not well enough to get my intention. Yeah. So do me and the fans a favor. If you post something like that, I don't care what it is, let us know.
Just listen to her. Listen, you should already, if you not subscribed to HPR, you already should be subscribed to HPR because of people like Ken Fallon, Mr. Gadgets, Klaatu, and all those other guys. I want to publicize HPR, not me being on HPR.
But that's you being modest. I know. You need to realize that you're a public personality and the people want to listen to anything you put out. At least most do. So do it. But I was already subscribed to HPR and I don't listen to everything because I have less time to listen to podcasts now. But I tell you, once I found out that you put out an episode, I downloaded it. I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm going to tonight so that I have a better understanding of it. But man, just do me a favor, tell me, and then I'll tell the world for you. How about that? That way you're only spreading it to one person. Whoever tells beyond that, it's not really, you know, you bragging. It's just you saying, hey, I did this. Check it out.
Well, and to be honest, my logic is about every month or so, I'm going to find something that I want to talk about and get off my chest. And HPR is by far the utterly perfect place to do zero, huge frigging goose egg, zero amount of work yet to a podcast. Because all you got to do is hit record, hit stop, send it as an email. Done. You don't go do anything else.
Well, then I'm going to make a commitment to get something sent to him because I have a couple things that I think I'd like to send to him. And when I do, I'll let you guys know. Very cool.
Thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up. Okay, quick, I shouted out to someone last week on Google Plus that sent me something. I'm going to shout out this week to Randy Noseworthy. This was very cool. Randy Noseworthy sent me a message saying, well, since I don't drive as much, I don't have as much time for other voices in my head as I'm thinking about something here or there or reading, but I think I can play around with Social Network and listen and drink coffee, but reading a book, not so much. And then in the message, he posted a screen cap, and what it was his G-Potter screen, and it showed a host of Podnuts shows, including our episode number 108. So he basically just sent it off to saying he has very little time to listen to podcasts, but when he does listen to podcasts, he listens to Podnuts and he listens to Linux, the rest of us, more importantly. So thank you, Randy, very much. Hope you enjoy the shows. If you have anything you want to hear from us, let us know. Hit me up on Google Plus. We'll work it in somehow.
Yeah, and I'll say Randy is behind Penguin, pimpingthepenguin.com. He also posted today, it was Show Off Your Desktop Friday or something, and it's a desktop where it's a picture of him with three different pictures of eating a cookie and drinking milk at the same time as doing a, I think he's doing a update on his operating system.
Okay.
And he's like calling, other people out to do the same. Randy, by far, besides being one of the nicest guys and open to just giving out information. He posts some good stuff.
Very cool. I'm going to have to follow him a little more closely. Very cool. Thank you, Randy, for sending that in. Moving on, Ryan Metcalf writes, this is my first time contacting Steve and Steve, and now Cody. I've been extremely impressed with the show and haven't missed a show yet. Quick question. What is needed to connect to an IRC chat room? This sounds like a dumb question, but I was listening to a recent episode and Dor was making a comment about getting connected, no matter how small. I also chuckled at the comparison of walking into a crowd and shouting, hello, everyone, how do you? Yeah, I agree. Building a rapport within a community is crucial. Good luck on the upcoming videos, Brian.
Thanks, sir.
So, yeah, Dor, I mean, I used IRC years ago to download video game ROMs because I had hacked a Dreamcast, and I was using that to get all sorts of game emulators and game ROMs onto that thing. But I probably haven't used IRC in like 10 years. I just never get on there. So what would you suggest for someone that in Ryan's case, or even in my case, that listens to the show, heard you talk about it? If you don't have an answer right now, we can wrap it up into next week and maybe go a little more in depth. But is there something real quick that you'd like to say based on that?
Well, I sent him a couple links. The gist of it is IRC's old technology, very old technology. Which means you got to jump through a couple steps. Yep. It isn't just like you go through a GUI, click two things, and then you're there.
Nope.
You actually have to create an account, validate an account, do some other things. I did send him a couple of links. I can make sure they're in the notes.
Very cool. Yeah, if we could get a hold of those, and maybe I'll make it mark to talk a little bit more about it next week, because it's definitely good to bring the awareness of such channels in order to talk to people and get help, which we need to do in this community. But if we can go a step further and provide some very specific instructions for people on how to get on IRC, I think that would be beneficial.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool. All right, just a couple, three more here, guys. James writes, thanks for yet another great show, Linux for the Rest of Us 106 in particular. You mentioned an app that you can't live without. I forgot what it was. I re-listened to the show and blow me down. I cannot find it. Could you please let me know what it was? I have been re-listening to all of your shows recently, and it could have been in any one of them as well. I have an hour-long commute into work every day and then another hour coming home. What a better way to spend this time than filling my mind with knowledge. Thanks again, James, from Tamsworth, Australia. Wow. Worldwide.
Yeah, that is very cool.
Very cool. So I'm pretty sure I was looking back through the notes. The app he was speaking about was your favorite launcher app, which, what is it called again? The little launchy app you use, which has all the nice things. You use it every day on every install. Kupfer? There you go. I was just making sure you could still say it right.
Yeah. So I'm just slow, that's all.
I knew what it was called. But yeah, Kupfer. And if you guys don't know about Kupfer, check it out. That's Kupfer. It's in the Ubuntu Software Center and most repos. Go check it out. Very, very cool. All right. Moving on, if I can bring it up one more time. Our good friend of the show, Ryan Ridenour, writes in, hey guys, since Wine allows you to run some Windows EXEs on Linux, is it possible to get a Windows virus through Wine or play on Linux? Also, it seems there is a faster turnaround time on posting of the show since Cody took over. One of the many benefits that I'm sure to come. Keep it up, Ryan. Ryan, let me just say right now, thank you for that. But Steve C has still been editing the shows. I'm learning to edit the shows. I'm trying to find a better DAW in order to. I'm currently using Ardour. I'm going to look around for some more. But I would say along those lines, they've probably been put out faster because Steve C doesn't have to be on the show anymore. Therefore, he has more free time to edit, and he's probably in a happier place because he's making some good music. So overall, I think his more positive attitude and lighter workload would contribute to why the shows are getting up faster, not the fact that I'm doing it. What do you say about that, Dor?
I understand that he thinks it's coming out faster. I don't think it's actually coming out any faster. And the virus thing, to be honest, we're going to need more time to answer that question fully because it isn't really cut and dry.
Yeah, I had an idea on how to answer it, and I was going to write him back, but I wanted to run it by you first. So why don't we, you want to delve into that deeper in the next show, kind of right off the bat?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So Ryan, tune into episode 111. For those of you guys who want to hear it, tune into episode 111. We'll try to address that real quick. All right. And very, very last email for the day by Rick Crouch writes in, Coop. On last week's podcast, you talked about getting your kids into tech, how early is too early, how to get them interested, and so on. As a longtime techie parent with very techie kids, I thought I'd share my experiences. First of all, I don't know that there is a too early. From the time he was born, I would hold my son on my lap while I would play games. He would watch the screen, listen to the sounds, and enjoy being with his dad. By the time he was two, he was playing with his own computer games, starting with a Winnie the Pooh game. The game basically consisted of clicking on things and seeing what happened. He would laugh hysterically when Pooh would get pelted with acorns from a nearby tree. It wasn't just games, either. By the time he was nine, he knew his way around a computer. I once got a frantic call from my accountant who needed some numbers for our business tax return. Unfortunately, my wife and I were out of town and weren't near the computer, so I called my son and had him log on into our computer, open the Excel file, and get the number for me. The other day, at our local library, I looked at my nine-year-old daughter's looked over my nine-year-old daughter's shoulder as she played educational games on the library computer. To my surprise, the computer was running Lubuntu, and she was navigating it like a pro. Don't worry about getting them interested in tech. It'll happen faster than you think. Rick. Well, thanks for writing in about that, Rick. And yeah, I think that starting them early with anything at all, I mean, I've been noticing with my son, it's more of that cause and effect when it comes to technology. Like, he's getting a hold of remote controls now and pressing buttons and looking up the screen and seeing what he just did. So he's trying to make those connections. So getting some educational games for him, I think, would be great. I just put him in front of a laptop today that I had Solus OS installed on, and I took a picture. I'm going to post onto Google Plus later and make sure to send it to Ikey, because I think he'll get a kick out of it. But the one thing I noticed, and basically if you guys have kids now and you're starting tech now, the one thing I'm noticing with him is when I handle my tablet and my phone, you know, he's used to touching the screen, obviously because of touchscreen devices and having things happen. With the laptop, he basically used the keyboard to pull himself up to the screen and started touching the screen on the laptop. So he hasn't made that connection yet, but he will in time.
Right.
So thank you for writing in, Rick. I really do appreciate it. What do you think about that one, Dora?
Oh, I think that's really cool.
Now, yeah. How old are your boys?
4 and 7.
4 and 7. And are they using computers yet?
My oldest son just wants to play Tux Paint, and my youngest son just wants to get between me and a computer.
Okay. So at least they're interested in the slightest sense as of yet. But right. Tux Paint is very fun. It's a nice creative tool. So yeah, for these guys who haven't messed with that, definitely give it a try.
Right.
All right. And those are all the emails we're going to read this week. We banged through quite a few of them, which is cool. I have a few more, but by all means, keep sending those in, and we'll definitely address more of them on the next show.
Actually getting a little bit later for me. I got to get ready to head out here, Cody. We do have a voicemail, too, that we're going to probably play maybe first thing in the next cast, but we are going to play it.
There you go. Yeah, and that was from Nightwise. He sent in a great voicemail, which I appreciate. And he also called me Coop. So I think that if that's okay with you, I'll just roll with that as a nickname.
I don't see why it would be bad for the show.
No. Well, but I'm basically asking your permission, because one person shouldn't dictate the nickname for themselves. Well, but
I mean, right now there's a thing out in AAA where it's between Ice Machine Cooper, Call a Cab Cooper, and there was another one. I can't remember what the other one was, but there's a couple of them out there. I say let the people pick, but, you know, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I haven't listened to AAA in a couple of weeks, so, oh, the voicemails I'll be sending in. Yeah. So tune into Android App Addicts. We'll figure it out. That makes a lot of sense, because Jeff Owens sent me a message calling me Call a Cab, but I thought it was just his, like, predict-a-text messing up. So, okay. Well, hey, if Dirty Thumbs wants to play Dirty, we'll play Dirty. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to say. One more time, guys, please, if you came into the episode late or came into the live chat late or forgot what I said earlier for 5 or 7 minutes, please go to podnuts.com/Kickstarter. Steve is running a Kickstarter for a great worthy cause for himself and for the future of Podnuts. Go check it out. Do what you can. Dor, any last words for the week?
I just want to thank everybody for coming out. As always, thanks for subscribing. Thanks for downloading. Most of all, thanks for the feedback.
Most definitely. And thank you. And I was so surprised and pleased with all the response I got from my question of the week for last week about my kids with Linux. And I don't have a question this week, but by all means, hit me up with anything on Google Plus. We'll integrate it into the emails for next week. I'm Cody Cooper, signing off. Dor, thank you very much for being on the show again, and we will talk to you guys next week.